Welcome back to Administrative Static. Mark Chenoweth here, joined by my litigation colleague here at NCLA, Shang Li. Shang, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Mark.
So Shang is going to be arguing a case in the you already argued the case in the First Circuit Court of Appeals past week, or I guess within the past week, Harper v. Werfel. So first of all, remind our listeners what this case is about, and then what kind of questions did you get at the oral argument?
So this case is about the IRS's power to obtain financial records without really telling the person who owns the financial records what's going on. So there's a statute that Congress passed that allows IRS to go to financial institutions and obtain what are called John Doe's summons. That is, they get records of people who they don't really know, and they can go to the bank or whatever to get the records. And as you can expect, that has a lot of abuses because the taxpayer doesn't have even notice of what's going on. So Congress enacted a protection for the taxpayer, saying, well, first of all, you have to not know who the person is. You know, this has to be an unidentified person, and when you go, you have to get the records for what's called an ascertainable group whom IRS reasonably believes may have evaded taxes. So
you can't just go on a fishing expedition. In theory, you have to say we have probable cause or at least reasonable suspicion. That this ascertainable group of people has engaged in, maybe they all participated in the same partnership, maybe they all used the same tax shelter. There's some reason to think that these individuals have not filed their taxes or paid their full share of taxes.
Exactly. And in the congressional report when they enacted this statute back in the 70s, the example was the shareholders of a company that went through through a reorganization that may have some tax consequences. You know, so you can determine who the group is, and because they all did the same thing, there's a common denominator that's tax evasion. But what IRS did here is exactly what Congress tried to prevent. That's a fishing expedition. They went to a cryptocurrency exchange, Coinbase. They actually went to a bunch of cryptocurrency exchanges. One of them is Coinbase, and they said, we think people who use cryptocurrency engage in tax evasion.
All of them, basically.
All of them. So we want records. It was a two-year period. We want records of all your customers for all their cryptocurrency transactions. And that number
seems like a broad request.
Yes, that number in the country would have been millions of people. Coinbase alone had a million customers at the time. So if you go to all the other exchanges, there would have been many million, I would think. The reviewing court out in California, a magistrate judge, ultimately whittled that down to about 20,000 Coinbase customers. And one of those customers was Jim Harper. His records was taken by IRS under this scheme, and he didn't even know about it. And only years later, Jim got a letter from IRS saying, hey, we got your records and you got to watch out. And Jim looked and he actually reported all of his cryptocurrency transactions and profits and that and owes no back taxes. And IRS doesn't allege he owes any back taxes. But what he did is he filed suit and said, hey, you violated the law getting this from me because you had no reasonable suspicion to believe I committed tax fraud.
And you abused the John Doe process because what you're supposed to do is ask them for my name. And once you have the name, then you can come to me for the records.
That's right.
Frankly, the IRS could have looked at their own records and could have seen that Jim paid all of his taxes or at least had filed and claimed lots of cryptocurrency on his tax returns.
Yeah, and behind the scenes here a little bit is that at the time, this is 2013 to 2015, IRS hasn't given taxpayers guidance on how to report their taxes. So Jim didn't report his taxes on, you know, his personal stuff because he used an S corp, a personal corporation, and reported all of them through his LLC. So, you know, IRS may have gone through his personal tax and said, no cryptocurrency transaction. But if they just cross-referenced it, this LLC that belongs to him had cryptocurrency transactions, they would have, you know, this matter would have been put to rest easily. But the matter is, like, the IRS just had no basis to have no reasonable basis to believe Jim as an individual or through some common feature that he shares with an ascertainable group used cryptocurrency to evade taxes and their collection of his
records. And yet his records were searched and seized anyway.
Exactly. And so this is just a clear phishing expectation and an abuse of the John Doe summons process.
And a violation of the Fourth Amendment.
That too. So there's a statutory and, again, a Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment, of course, protects protects individuals from unreasonable government searches and seizures, and was designed to at the founding to prevent this exact kind of fishing expedition, what's called the general warrant in the colonial era, where, you know, the king or his governor would say, we think fishy things are going on, so we're going to go door to door and look for stuff.
Or go to Sheng's house and grab all of his papers and we'll find something.
Exactly.
There.
So so what it requires is for authorities to have individualized suspicion of some sort of wrongdoing, which just did not exist here.
So now, what kind of questions did you get from the court? Did you have a sense that they were at all sympathetic to the arguments that you were making?
Unfortunately, we didn't get a lot of questions on the statutory component. This, you know, the need for an ascertainable group whom there's reasonable belief for tax evasion. And I think that's unfortunate because I think that's you know, because that was a recently enacted statute, and I think the court should have been paid more attention to that.
It's pretty clear what the intent of the statute is. Exactly.
It's to protect John Does from these abusive summons. There was a lot of questions on the Fourth Amendment, and maybe the court would just, you know, more focused on the broader constitutional question here.
Well, they probably get Fourth Amendment cases more often, right? So maybe an area they're more familiar
That's
with.
That's true, too. Probably also in the criminal context where someone did commit a crime or alleged to have committed a crime, where here everyone agrees Jim was completely innocent. But in any event, so there's this case out based in the 1970s called Miller v. United States, which created something called the third party doctrine, which allows the idea is your Fourth Amendment,
which is not part of the Fourth Amendment,
which is,
but I mean, it is now under precedent, but
yeah,
it's
was,
not in the original text.
There was a line under the Fourth Amendment that your protection is based on what's called the reasonable expectation of privacy. And if under this doctrine, if you voluntarily share information or secrets or whatnot with a third party, then that expectation of privacy disappears and the government can seize it. And under Miller, that was a bank case.
That sounds like the legal version of two can keep a secret if one of them is dead.
Exactly. So under Miller, what it was the guy had some bank records. The IRS went and got them, and they were successfully able to argue that because Miller shared these records with his bank, he had no expectation of privacy to them. Now, you can kind of see if this gets taken to the extremes, it kind of eviscerates the privacy, even private phone calls. Someone else is on the other line. So there's a lot of scholars and even judges who really don't think this third-party doctrine was well-founded, and certainly not in the modern age when you're working with third parties all the time. Your cell phone provider has information about you, your everyday location. Every email, every Gmail you send to somebody is technically stored at a third-party server.
Can't all be open to the government on that basis.
Exactly. So there's been in the judiciary, you know, doctrines, you know, this is what happens when you start with a bad doctrine. You have a doctrine, then bad doctrine, or the bad privacy-based doctrine, then a bad third-party doctrine to kind of change that, and then a, you know, bad exceptions to it.
You create a hole in the Constitution, and the government's going to drive a Mack truck through it. I mean, that happens every time.
Yeah. So here, in a recent case in Carpenter, the Supreme Court started poking holes in the third-party doctrine and saying, well, if the information that the third party holds is really pervasive and it's intimate and it reveals a lot about you, you still keep your expectation of privacy. And so the argument we made on the Fourth Amendment in this respect is that, well, cryptocurrency is different because with the transaction logs that you get from the crypto exchanges, they can actually just unlock all your crypto exchanges for all time, because what happens is you're...
For everyone, for the world to see.
For the world to see, because usually what happens on a cryptocurrency exchange or transaction is your, you know, private anonymized
ID,
it's a wallet address is put onto the public blockchain, and that's, you know, not a problem if no one knows that's your ID. But when the government gets it from Coinbase and there's a stamp that says this is Jim Harper's transaction and his ID is this chain of alphanumeric numbers,
it'd be like everything being attached to your Social Security number, which is fine as long as no one knows it's your Social Security number.
Exactly. And now the government has it, and they can search Jim's crypto transaction records, not just you know, those 2 years, but for all time.
And going forward.
And so the argument is that is a Fourth Amendment violation, notwithstanding this third-party issue, because it's an all-encompassing backwards-looking kind of historical view that reveals intimate aspects of his life, and he therefore has an expectation of privacy to it. And
it's almost like agreeing to future searches.
Exactly.
I mean, he didn't agree to it, but I mean, it's almost the consequence would be the same.
And so one of the judges, Judge Lopez, was really focused on that issue, which was very encouraging, and pushed the government on the idea of, well, you know, it does seem here that his anonymity on the blockchain has been pierced, and isn't that a basis to differentiate Jim's case from Miller's case back in the 1970s when the technology was very different?
Well, that is encouraging and interesting. Any other questions? So the argument's taken place. I assume you don't know when the decision will be coming out, but was there any other takeaways from from argument day?
Yeah, the other takeaway is that the judge in the center, whose name I misplaced
Was it Kenyatta or?
Kenyatta. He ruled against us in our relentless Chevron case. So that's where I remember him from. And it was not,
So John remembers his name.
Exactly. John remembers his name. So another way of getting around the third party doctrine is Justice Gorsuch brought up this theory where, well, actually, the information you give to a third party, your bank, your cell phone provider, your email, provider, they're really just holding it for you as a bailment, and you still have a property interest in it. And so when the government takes it, it's a violation of your property interest under the kind of sort of the original property-based understanding of the Fourth Amendment.
Right. So I left my car with a valet the last time I valet parked. That's a bailment. The government can't come in and take my car and say, well, you already shared it with a third party, so now we can search it freely or whatever.
Exactly. And so his questioning really suggests that he didn't think much of Justice Gorsuch's bailment theory. He thinks these records, because they were created as part of, by the third party and held by the third party, they're part of the property of the third party. But of course, property law in this country is determined by contract. So really what you need to look at is what does the contract say and where the contract assigns the property.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for coming to share the oral argument with us. This is Harper v. Werfel in the First Circuit, U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit. If folks want to look it up there, or they can go to our website, nclalegal.org, and find more information there. Thank you, Shane.
Thank you.